Next, we're happy to have Henry Maxfield. Henry completed his PhD at Durham with Veronica Hubany. He was a postdoc at McGill, and he's currently an It from Qubit postdoc at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's worked on various aspects of quantum gravity and holography. And Henry has asked he's going to pause for questions at various points, but he asks that we save any deep philosophical questions for the end of the talk. So please take it away, Henry.
Thanks for the introduction, Will, and thanks for the organizers for putting together this nice conference at a difficult time. It's really nice to have a sort of diverse group of people of different backgrounds to share opinions and ideas with. Particularly for this, what I'm going to tell you, I'd really love to solicit everyone's sort of point of view. And I'm going to try to put these recent developments about replica wormholes and so forth that we've heard about a few times this week in a sort of hopefully a broad and conservative perspective that everyone can engage with to some extent. Okay, so let's start with reviewing an old problem that it goes back to 1974 and Hawking, which is the tension or apparent tension between quantum mechanics and general relativity. And this is the sharp question that I'm going to ask at the moment, is whether black hole formation and evaporation is consistent with a unitary quantum mechanics. And a sort of second, slightly stronger question is that if we do have a unitary description of that a distant observer uses to make predictions about Hawking radiation and so forth, whether the number of states in that description is counted by the Beckenstein-Hawking entropy. So one very specific sort of question, I mean, this was something that was called the central dogma by Almeri and collaborators in their recent review. I'm going to give it a slightly more descriptive name and less dogmatic name, because it's just a proposal, which is slightly stronger than unitarity, as I say, which is saying that if a distant observer makes measurements on black holes and Hawking radiation, then they can effectively forget that what they're measuring is a black hole and just think of it as some perfectly ordinary quantum system, and they're throwing things into this quantum system and seeing what comes out. And this version of Beckenstein-Hawking unitarity says that this is described by unitarity in a Hilbert space with dimension given by the Beckenstein-Hawking entropy. So just to contrast this with other possibilities, the obvious one is information loss, which is that there's some initial state, initial pure state, say, evolves to a mixed state at the end. But this is, because this is something a little stronger, another possibility is that of remnants, which is that perhaps the initial state to final state evolution evolved pure states to pure states in a unitary way. But if that information, if you like, only comes out once the black hole is some Planckian size, then that means that there's no way you can describe that quantum mechanics with this number of states. In fact, you'd need to have a Hilbert space that's much, much bigger to contain all the possible internal states that a very big black hole could have, even in a very small black hole. Okay, so we're going to try to ask this question, whether this is true. And I want to take this, for now, from a very conservative point of view, and hopefully a very universal point of view, using principles that are well established and that I think we can all agree on, and ask what should we expect using these things we know and love. So what I'm going to do is just compute observables at infinity. So I'll work in asymptotically flat space for the purposes of this. So just measure things at scry plus. So create some initial state at scry minus and then measure things at scry plus. I'm only going to use low energy gravitational effective field theory, which in the form of, I'll write it in the form of a path integral, but in the end, everything is equivalent to everything else, so it shouldn't really matter too much. But this will be the convenient way to present the ideas. And I'm only going to use, so by the semi-classical path integral, I'll explain a little more what I mean. This means I'm looking for saddle points of some classical action. And those saddle points, I'm only going to use them if they sort of have low curvature everywhere, and I really think I can trust them in effective field theory. So very conservative ingredients. And the question we ask then is whether the predictions you get from just looking for these saddle points that we can trust, are they consistent with this thing I called Bekenstein Hawking unitarity. So in particular, I'm not going to use any geometries that have large curvatures anywhere. I'm not going to make use of any particular UV completion, string theory, loop quantum gravity, or the other things we've heard about this week. I'm going to be hopefully completely independent of what UV completion. And in particular, I'm not going to use any version of duality or sort of assume any unitarity. It's going to be just put in these ingredients and see whether unitarity comes out. Okay. So just to preview the conclusions, hopefully I'll get through all of it in good time, but give you some preview that the new developments of replicable wormholes have given us here is that an observer, asymptotic observer, the predictions made by these ingredients are in fact, despite what people have said for many years, turn out to be consistent with this Bekenstein-Hawking unitarity. But this appears to come with some cost, which is that there's not a single unitary theory, if you like. There's not a single unitary S matrix, but there's some statistical description of what the S matrix should be. And this is perhaps controversial, but I think I'll try to convince you from these very, very very conservative starting point. Okay, so I'm going to go through this in for pedagogical reasons. It's also nice to go through it historically. There are going to be sort of three landmarks separated by 20-odd years between them. And I'll pause for questions a few times, and I really like people to, if the sort of technical aspects of the how the calculation is working or the sort of ingredients that are going in are unclear, then I'd really like to encourage questions. But probably the broader discussion of more open-ended things, it's probably easier to wait to the end and discuss over cocktails and Wemo and Slack and all the rest of it. Okay, so we'll begin with Hawking's calculation in 1975, we're just going to start off with quantum field theory on a fixed background. This will be useful because this is perhaps familiar to most people in a sort of Hamiltonian formulation. I'm going to describe how you should think about this in the path integral, which is perhaps unfamiliar. So it's good to start with a calculation that's probably familiar to most because the language might be unfamiliar. Okay, so here's a picture of a black hole formed from collapse that you just get from straight classical GR. There's some star and it's got an event horizon, some singularity, and so forth. And what we're interested in doing is measuring some observable that lives at asymptotic infinity here. So we collect some radiation and do some measurements on it, far from the black hole. Hawking did this is you take this operator, you just do the Hamiltonian Heisenberg evolution back to scry minus, so you can sort of trace this operator around the Heisenberg evolution, it goes back in, there's some scattering off the potential here, and you trace everything back to scry minus. So it means you write this, say, maybe this is a local operator on scry plus, and it becomes some non-local operator on scry minus. But you do this Heisenberg evolution. So for example, for Hawking's calculation, he did it for free matter. And so you write the annihilation coefficients on scry plus as some linear combination of creation and annihilation coefficients on scry minus. And then you just evaluate this operator once you've evolved it back to evaluate this on the ingoing state, which is will take to be basically a vacuum state with no particles. Hawking's calculation, you get some occupation numbers that are related to these Bogoliubov coefficients here. And in particular, note that we never had to use this region inside the horizon to do this evolution. All the evolution took place on the outside, and so we were never sensitive to these regions of strong curvature, and never had to talk about this. Okay, so that's... That's how Hawking did the calculation. I'm going to use the path integral, so let's just restate everything in that language. This is sort of standard quantum field theory type calculations that are very natural in most experimental circumstances where you prepare your experiment with some known initial state, but you don't do a complete measurement on the final state. Yeah, so you don't want to have to completely specify a final state because you only want to measure some particular observable. And then the right way to formulate things is the so-called Inner or Schwinger-Keldysh formulas. And the way that works is you have this, you end up with two copies of the space-time. So if you like, we have here we had this Heisenberg evolution. Okay, so here we had this Heisenberg evolution from Scry plus back to Scry minus. So that you can think of as applying, taking O to U, O, U dagger, the usual kind of Heisenberg thing. And this piece of the space-time you could think of as computing U, unitary evolution, and this computes U dagger. And between them, they evolve the thing back. So we have our initial state, then we have some final Cauchy surface. Doesn't really matter where it is, as long as it coincides with the location of our operator on Scry Plus. And then we glue these two guys, these two space-times along this future surface. And in particular, so this means we do the path integral on this double geometry. And in particular, notice again that the strong curvature regions are not particle geometry. Is this background noise, is there really bad background noise? Because if so, I'll mute.
We can still hear you. It's noticeable, but I think we're okay to proceed. I mean, you have a question from Lee if you want to take it now or wait.
Yeah. So if there's a question about this, I mean, so at the moment this is very, very good. You know, this is that. Hopefully, this is so far completely uncontroversial, but it's a good time to take a question.
Totally uncontroversial. It's just a clarification about your claim of where you're going to. If you have a statistical distribution over pure states, is your theory irreversible or reversible?
Delay that question to the end?
Certainly.
I'd like to, yeah, to make sure I get through sort of through everything and get the full perspective before those the more open-ended questions. For now, I'd like to take the narrow technical questions. Thanks, Lee. Do ask it again. Yeah. One more thing to say is how we compute entropy using this, because this is going to be the sort of starring thing. So we'll take the, not quite compute the entropy, but rather compute trace of rho squared. So this is the second Renyi entropy. And this requires two copies of the density matrix. So that means that I have my Bra and Ket spacetimes forming my Schwinger-Keldysh contour. And then I have another copy of the Bra and Ket spacetimes. And now my observable is something that acts not just on a single copy of Scry Plus, but rather it acts on two copies of Scry Plus, and it acts to exchange them. So there's this this gluing of this region before some retarded time U. So this is glued to the same region, but on the second copy. So this is what this swap operator does. It exchanges, it acts to exchange these two copies on this region that I'll call Scry U, which is a piece of asymptotic infinity. And this is something we can generalize to n copies. And there's a sort of formal limit of this that will be useful. And if you were to do this for Hawking's calculation, the entropy you end up at, the von Neumann entropy you end up at, is essentially the thermal entropy that Hawking has. So in particular, it grows over time. So let's this was all QFT on a fixed background. Let's step it up and let gravity be dynamical. So that means we're integrating over metrics. And a useful way to think about this is we have, this is the matter integral we were doing before. So some matter with some fields phi on a parametric G. And then we do the integral over metrics as well. So we can think about this as you integrate out the matter to give yourself an effective action. And then what we're going to look for is saddle points in this effective action, which is the Einstein-Hilbert metric action plus whatever matter. And the boundary conditions to this path integral are going to be to fix the asymptotic geometry, but otherwise we're going to be agnostic about what goes in. So we only what goes on the inside. So the asymptotic geometry means we fix something at Scry minus and Scry plus, insert some operator at Scry plus, but then we integrate over everything consistent with that boundary condition. This is maybe a picture of what you get. So we all know that at least that the bottom half of this picture is again uncontroversial. The that integrating out the matter means that the black hole starts to evaporate, it gets small, and eventually it, in this region curly E, the end point or the evaporation point, it becomes Planckian, and perhaps it evaporates completely. Okay, we can be agnostic about this, and in the end, we're not going to make any use of this region up here, which requires knowledge of what goes on at the end point. So in particular, there's this retarded time U evaporation, which is where an asymptotic observer would see some Planckian black hole. We're only going to make observations before that time. So that means we don't have to worry about this region. So in particular, to compute the density matrix in this evaporating space-time, but only on the region, some region, scry U, that up to some finite retarded time, you'll have a path integral on some space like this. And we glue on this Cauchy surface, glue the Brar and Ket together, and this Cauchy surface, again, stays away from regions of strong curvature, so we don't need to assume anything about those regions. Okay. So from this calculation, this is essentially Hawking's calculation, and we know that this density matrix rho of U is basically thermal. It doesn't contain any correlations, particularly between the very late radiation and very early radiation. So that means the entropy just goes up and up and up and up forever. And in the meantime, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy goes down. And after this page time, we have a problem with this Bekenstein-Hawking utility. Okay. So that's the sort of traditional point of view. But I want to take a very sort of experimental point of view and ask how we actually check this. Entropy is not something that's directly observable. So let's imagine we're an experimenter and our theorist has told us that the information should be lost and we should measure a mixed state. Let's go out and check it. But to do this, we need to have several copies of the Hawking radiation and make joint measurements on them. So for example, we can measure this swap operator. And I've drawn the picture here as the picture I gave before with these boundary conditions on the outside, but I don't know necessarily what goes on the inside. So I'm going to specify these boundary conditions that involve these gluings that swap the two copies, but look for the interesting things that might go on in the middle. And I'm going to call the result of measuring things like this swap operator, I'm going to call it the swap entropy, which I think covers the entropy that I would expect. If I was an experimentalist, I'd do experiments on many, many copies of Hawking radiation. From that, I would deduce the Rényi entropy or a von Neumann entropy. And this is the thing I call the swap entropy. And this is going to turn out to be distinct from this actual von Neumann entropy computed by Hawking. So that's going to be one of the important things. So naively, of course, we just have this two copies of this. This is the cutoff point we had before. Naively, we have two copies. So that means that the density matrix of two sets of Hawking radiation is just two sets of Hawking radiation. It doesn't change. Okay, how am I doing for time, Will? When do I start? If there are any questions now, is it good?
15? Oh, sorry. You started at 1:15 and questions start at 1:50, so you've got...
20, okay. Yeah. 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay.
I'm not sure if Lee has a follow-up question. And also... it's been commented to me that the noise is, although I think we can still hear you, it's a little annoying. If it's not too much trouble, can you move? Is it possible to move inside, or would that be too much of a challenge?
I can do that.
Okay. Thanks, Henry.
Yeah. Sorry, I have to. There is a sleeping ER doctor upstairs who has a much more important job than me, so I have to be quiet about it.
Okay.
Okay. Right.
Thank you. I don't think there are any other questions unless... I don't see any hands raised at the moment, so...
Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, good. So as a bit of a warm-up for these replicable wormholes... it's useful to make a sort of historical digression, because these will turn out to be useful things to sort of upgrade into replicable wormholes. Now, to make this historical digression, I need to go slightly beyond the paradigm described before and make some assumptions about this endpoint of evaporation. I'll just assure you now that eventually we won't need this. It's just useful as a sort of pedagogical crutch to help us get to the final answer. And this is a proposal of Polchinski and Strominger. The assumption I'll make is basically that this is what the Penrose diagram looks like. So in particular, stuff that's inside the black hole doesn't somehow propagate through a Planckian region, make it to the outside. But again, this is not going to be necessary in the end. So we're going to treat this, the stuff that's on the inside, union square plus, like a Cauchy surface in the end. So anything is either going to end up inside the black hole or end up a square plus, but not both. Okay, and if we do that, let's compute, if we do that, now we can compute things on the entirety of Scribe Plus, which will be a sort of helpful thing to do, is a little bit simpler. So let's compute two copies of the density matrix on two copies of the radiation. So rho H is the sort of Hawking density matrix that is computed from this subtle point that we had before, except now I'm just gluing the two guys together on the interior. So this is the sort of usual picture of you collapse the radiation and you trace out what's in the interior. And the obvious thing to do to compute two copies of this density matrix is to just take two copies of this subtle point. But from this point, it's clear there's another option. And that option is you identify things by exchanging these two guys. And this is actually precisely the same subtle point as this. I've just relabeled the two sort of ket spacetimes, if you like. So that means I have now two terms. And in particular, the two copy density matrix is not just a product of one copy density matrices. So one way to write this is you take the just two copies of the Hawking density matrix, and then there's one, which is the usual subtle point, plus a thing that swaps the two. And this is the answer we get. And in particular, this two copy density matrix, if I hit it with a swap operator, then nothing happens because S times one is S and S times S is one. So the two terms just get swapped. So if I measure this swap operator, I always get one. So a swap operator has eigenvalues plus one and minus one. And if my state is highly mixed, I get those values sort of 50-50. But here I always get one. And that means with very, very few measurements, I can determine this state is really pure. And the sort of swap entropy, the thing that encodes what asymptotic observers see, is matching with a pure state of Hawking radiation, if we include this subtle point. So this sounds great, but as pointed out by these guys in 1994, this doesn't really solve the problem. So in particular, we had to make these assumptions about what happens at the endpoint of evaporation, which is something we'd like to avoid doing. In particular, it doesn't actually give us this Bekenstein-Hawking unitarity. You don't get the page curve. Probably in the interest of time, ask me later why this is true. It's basically because black holes, when they evaporate, they're not a reversible process. They produce thermal entropy. And it means that the entropy you get is this black curve, whereas the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is this red curve. And there's a violation of the entropy bound, if you like, here. By some order one quantity. And you can actually make these violations as bad as you like if you keep throwing things into the black hole. And it may not even be that this is a consistent thing. So we need to do a little bit better than this if we want something really satisfactory. So that's where we're going to go next. This brings us to the sort of up to date. So here on the left is the picture what we had of the Polchinski-Strominger type wormhole where we swap interiors, except now this is the thing that computes not the swap on the entirety of this radiation, on the entirety of Scry Plus, but rather, this should be Scry U, sorry. So we're just measuring the entropy on some piece of Scry Plus before evaporation. So this is what the Polchinski-Strominger subtle point looks like. So it means that one way of saying it is that gravity has dynamically decided to swap the black hole interiors. That is, we've summed over all the possibilities whether they're swapped or unswapped, and it's sort of dynamical, a question as to whether these interiors get swapped. Now, the replicable wormhole the basic idea is simple here. Instead of just swapping black hole interiors, we choose some completely arbitrary or potentially arbitrary Cauchy surface to swap on. So there's this, so I've sort of zoomed in on the right-hand side here. Here's a Cauchy surface. There's scry U, which is the piece of infinity where we're making a measurement. Then there's some exterior piece of the Cauchy surface. And then there's some interior piece of the Cauchy surface. And the gluing of scry U and, in fact, the exterior Cauchy surface is fixed by the boundary conditions. So this we have to swap because we're measuring a swap operator. This we have to not swap because there's a definition of what's going on just after the time U. But then on the interior, we decide to swap again. And this is now some compact Cauchy surface, so it's bounded by some codimension 2 surface gamma. So this is going to be the key kind of player. So this is what the topology looks like. It's got this sort of funny pattern of gluings between different things. So of course the question now is whether there's actually a saddle point with this topology. And I'll sort of go through this quite quickly so I have time to talk about baby universes, and people have talked about, this is essentially the same calculation people have used before with perhaps a slightly different interpretation. But the basic idea is the strongest evidence of this comes from generalizing this calculation to having n copies. You can reformulate a calculation in such a way that n doesn't have to be an integer anymore. And then you look at n very, very close to 1. And then you can reformulate this thing. So there's a matter integral, which gives you Renyi entropies of the matter propagating on a background. There's a gravitational action, which gives you some piece proportional to the area. And these all combine together to give you this this so-called generalized entropy that we've already heard about this week, so I won't belabor it. But this is, so for integer n, there's a lot of work to do to really understand better what these saddle points look like. But I think this is very strong evidence that these should actually exist at finite n as well, and there's various constructions. So I think there's very good evidence, but perhaps still more work to do to really establish that with full detail and care. But the important thing for us is that one of these quantum extremal surfaces, which is a signature that there is a saddle point of this topology, these exist in the evaporating black hole context. And this is what we found in a paper a year or so, or 18 months ago with, so it was a paper by Jeff Pennington and Ahmed Almhiri, Nestor Engelhardt, and Dom Rolf. We found that there is some non-trivial quantum extremal surface, something we've heard about already this week. So that means we have two possible saddle points to include. One is sort of two copies of this traditional Hawking saddle point, if you like, and one is this replicable wormhole with the extra swap. And this saddle point actually becomes dominant for late times. And between these two, we get a page curve. So you get the black curve on the way up and then the red curve on the way back down again. So this is a signature that the observables, so this is again, some experimentalist has created many, many copies of the black hole and collected all Hawking radiation and done lots of experiments and deduced an entropy from that by doing his experiments. And what he deduces is the page curve. That's the claim. Okay, oops. Oh, sorry. Press the wrong button. Are we back? Yeah. Okay, are there any more questions? I think I've got 3 minutes left or something?
Yeah, that's right. I don't see any questions at the moment. So I think you can go on.
Okay, so let's go through this quickly. What have we arrived at? We've arrived at something very confusing because we've computed observables, things that we actually, expectation values of measurements, and found that these guys are compatible with this Bekenstein-Hawking unitarity. In particular, they give us the page curve. And using only these ingredients of semi-classical gravity. And yet we also computed the density matrix of radiation up to some retarded time U, and we got Hawking's result, which is highly mixed and is not compatible with Bekenstein-Hawking unitarity. So what gives? And to answer this, it's useful to ask about the Hilbert space interpretation. This goes back to old ideas, really developed in the late 80s by Coleman, Giddings, and Strominger in particular, that the Hilbert space interpretation here is coming. There's a sum over intermediate states on this interior piece, which we can think of as a closed so-called baby universe, and that gives rise to the superselection sectors for observers making measurements at infinity. So let's 3 minutes is going to be okay. I think I can probably make it. So yeah, how do we Hilbert space interpretation is something you get by taking a path integral and you look at what contributes to your path integral and you slice it open somewhere and you look what is running in the intermediate channels. So in Hawking's calculation, we compute the density matrix using this sort of saddle point, and we can. If we want to cut this open, we have to cut it open along this interior Cauchy slice. Of course, the state is pure on the union of Scribe Plus and the interior Cauchy slice, but there's this sum over intermediate states. And roughly speaking, this traces out the interior and you end up with a mixed state like this on Scribe Plus. And this is mixed due to entanglement with some closed universe, which you like, which is the interior of the black hole. Okay, so what happens to Polchinski-Strominger? Is we now have these two copies. Again, we slice this path integral open by cutting along black hole interiors. We again have a pure state on n copies of Scribe Plus and n copies of this black hole interior. But because there's this swap, we actually modify the inner product in a particular way between these closed universes. And one way to describe this is that closed universes act like indistinguishable bosonic particles, so that the inner product of a pair of closed universes involves a symmetrization, which is familiar perfectly from particle physics. So you should think of closed universes as bosons. And this gives us a new the sort of change. And replicable wormholes just modify this inner product further. So they involve this inner product becomes something a little more involved that I won't describe because of time. And the last thing I'll say is that there's a this is kind of nice to have examples of how this inner product between closed universes is performing the role of creating superselection sectors, but there's a more abstract way of doing things that says this is really going to work for the gravitational path integral in general. And the important point here is that if you just look at observables at Scribe Plus, asymptotic observables in general, then these form a commutative algebra of operators on closed universes. The basic reason for this is that if I want to compute two sets of observables, so this is say two copies of a density matrix at infinity, then I can swap this density matrix with this density matrix and it doesn't matter, it's the same boundary conditions. So this is why things commute. And you can build a Hilbert space like this and abstractly show that there's some particular basis of states for closed universes which diagonalize these commuting set of asymptotic observables. So that means that there's some classical probability distribution of what measurements are. So the outcome is that there's that any observer will measure some particular unitary theory, it's just that gravity doesn't predict any specific unitary theory. Rather, it predicts a probability distribution. Okay, so this is my last slide. Sorry if I went through that last bit a little quickly. Hopefully it gave somewhat of a flavor of the ideas. It wasn't supposed to be a complete complete explanation. But the conclusion is that semi-classical gravity using just these very conservative, well-understood ingredients seems now to make predictions that are in line with this sort of unitarity. But this has come with a cost. And the cost is that this non-trivial space of closed universes has played an important role. And because these closed universes, for asymptotic observers, they're some unobservable sector. This means that we end up with some statistical predictions of the theory. And I guess I'll leave the open questions there for everyone to read, and if they want to ask any questions now or over cocktails or on Remo or Slack or so forth, then I'd really love to hear people's ideas on this. So thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Henry. We have a bunch of questions lined up. maybe since Lee asked early on, we can start with him.
Yeah.
Okay. If you get a statistical distribution of final states, including the baby universes, suppose that the parameters of the standard model are dynamical variables. Would you predict a statistical distribution of those parameters in the different universes? In other words, could this help address the landscape scenario?
So in principle, yes. The slight challenge here is that actually something that was implicit in all of this is that we chose some initial state of closed universes to begin with. We chose a sort of Hadley-Hawking state without any extra boundaries. And that choice is always implicitly there. The Hadley-Hawking state is a very natural state to start with. So in principle, one could get statistical predictions. One thing I might add is I expect that most things that you would observe here, most things like scattering amplitudes, parameters in the standard model, I would expect to have very, very small variances, exponentially small variances in this distribution. It's only very fine-grained things if you're trying to look at density matrices of Hawking radiation of very big black holes or something, that the variance is going to be very large. Predictions.
I'd argue with you given the time, but if we have a theory where the parameters are dynamical and different vacua are associated with different values of the standard model parameter, then I don't see why you'd get a narrow distribution, but we could discuss it.
Sure.
Okay, I think Nyesh was next.
Hello, so very interesting. I have a question about, what happens to the fireball paradox?
It's a short question that sends us down a deep rabbit hole. This is the last of my open questions that I think need more consideration. And the short answer is I'm not sure. One of the important things here is that these alpha states, these superselection sectors, are superselection sectors for asymptotic observers. A superselection sector is not just a property of a Hilbert space, it's a property of a Hilbert space and an algebra of observables. But an infalling observer, someone who jumps into the black hole, is measuring things that are not in that algebra anymore. So actually this gives us a nice way to have some consistency between something that looks unitary in the outside because you live in a superselection sector and yet gets smooth interiors on the inside. But these are just sort of fluffy words at the moment and it would be good to put some meat on them.
Okay, thanks.
Hal Haggard also has his hand up. Hal?
Thanks, Henry, for a really nice talk. I'll ask the question in two ways, partly just because of the juxtaposition of your talk with Monica Pates. I'm curious how you see this speaking with the proposal that the soft modes give us a way to think about the microstates of the black hole. But more generally, I'm curious about what insights you feel you've gained about the microstates.
My understanding of these sort of asymptotic soft modes is quite rudimentary. So I think it's something that I need to discuss more with the experts. But they seem to be very closely tied to what really happens out at infinity, and they don't seem to be particularly universal. Here, actually, the asymptotics are not playing a terribly important role. So there's a version of this in ADS where there's no infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetry group and so forth. So for me, I don't think they're playing a crucial role here. But again, I'm from a position of ignorance. In terms of what we learn about the microstates, it sounds kind of bad that we're not getting a specific prediction for what microstates are, but this is actually a great opportunity because trying to describe individual microstates in a chaotic theory is, of course, a very, very, it's an impossible problem. You need exponential accuracy to describe it and so forth. But If you want to only say statistical things about this, then there's a deep and beautiful theory that tells us a huge amount about these things. And you know, this is one of the really exciting developments in the last year or so, is actually using gravity to understand quantum chaotic systems in this more statistical way. Actually, gives us an opportunity to learn a lot about quantum chaotic systems.
Thank you.
Okay. I think Laurent posted a question in the chat. Laurent, do you want to unmute and ask it?
Hello, Henry. Thanks for the talk. Yeah, the question is just a question of clarification. I want to understand a little bit better what mathematically and conceptually what you call baby universes there in your context. Like, should I think of them as superposition of black hole interior? Do they carry, what kind of charges do they carry? And then at some point you were very fast with the argument. You said they cannot be described by quantum theory. It has to be a statistical theory. But I missed the point of why it's so clear. So whatever you have to say about somehow the definition of what they are.
Yeah. So in general, the Hilbert space of baby universes here is it's just a Hilbert space of any closed universes. So in this context of black holes, it looks like these evaporating black holes are a particular way to create some large baby universe, potentially. But in general, it's a Hilbert space of closed universes, which we can think of, at least to leading order in some approximation, as like a Fock space of, so maybe H sigma int, you can think of as a Hilbert space of all possible closed universes with a single connected component, and it's like a Fock space built out of that, and you could take any superpositions of these things. But more generally,
is it clear, for instance, that, I mean, classically they're completely disconnected, but sometimes in quantum mechanics you have exponential tails that reach whatever other region. So this notion of tunneling, like something is not classically allowed, but in fact, so I mean, there's states like that which are, you know, so. Is it clear that it's completely disconnected from the asymptote? Yeah, if you really had a quantum theory.
So this is where this abstract construction comes in. So this is described in paper in the spring with Don Marolf in the context of ADS, but really the asymptotics aren't playing a terribly important role. The idea is that you make some complete measurement. So you prepare some initial state and make a complete measurement on the final state. Describe some boundary condition at some asymptotic boundary, and then you can construct the Hilbert space by, roughly speaking, sort of cutting and looking at intermediate states. And because you've made a complete prescription of the asymptotic boundary values, you can interpret this as an inner product of closed universes. Whether this is geometric in an obvious way or so forth is not so obvious, but. And then the second question is whether this is described by quantum mechanics. The only observation here is that if you have quantum mechanics, but you only have access to a commuting set of observables, then it's completely equivalent to classical probability. So relative phases are unobservable unless if you can only measure a commuting set of observables. So So that's the.
It's more undecided than clear.
Sorry, it's more.
It's more undecided than clear. Sometimes when you have super selection sector, it's because, you know, you have an ignorance about the conjugate variables to alpha, right, to the super selection parameter. In most cases where we're super selection sector, we know we can embed a theory in a bigger theory where we finally understand what is the operator they diagonalize and their conjugate.
Absolutely. So this is one of the really important points here, is that there's actually a single unique quantum mechanical description of the whole system. But if you only allow yourself access to observables at asymptotic infinity, then you land in a superselection sector. And if you want to sort of see interference between alpha states and so forth, then you need to measure something that's more refined. You need to jump into a black hole, which I think I'm not brave enough to do.
Okay. There are a couple more questions, but since we've just run out of time, maybe we can do those in the Slack space. And also, there is a virtual cocktail reception at 2:30 on Remo. The link Astrid has just put into the chat. I will warn you that Bianca mixes a very strong virtual martini, so to exercise caution there. And we have a virtual dinner at 3:00 at which you are invited to eat real dinner virtually. And thanks again to Henry and Monica and the previous speakers from today. So let's close there. Thanks.